Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, October 17, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a telephone discussing patent venue and the fallout since the T.C. Heartland and Kraft Foods Supreme Court case decision. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Mr. Joel B. Ard of Foster Pepper and Mr. Michael Friedland, partner at Kenobi Martins. I will turn it over to Mr. Ard to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Joel. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much. So Mike and I have teamed up to do this because although a lot of what we are going to talk about are areas we agree on, we also have slightly different perspectives. I tend to do a little more patent defense work and Mike a little bit more on the plaintiff side, but we've both represented plaintiffs and defendants in what has been one of the most interesting and rapidly changing areas of the law. Really ever. The last 5 months have been pretty amazing. I'm going to start by giving a little bit of groundwork of how we got where we are. I think the questions that are going to come up in patent venue litigation and have come up recently are extraordinarily interesting and are going to produce a lot of excellent work for patent lawyers, but you can't really understand why those are questions if you don't have a good sense of how we got here. So T.C. Heartland was a decision by the Supreme Court on May 22nd of this year affecting patent venue. And essentially, distilled to its essence, the decision said, when you're asking what the appropriate venue is for a patent case, you have to read 28 U.S.C. 1400B, and it stands on its own and you don't read anything else. And that was a sea change after 27 years of Federal Circuit precedent to the contrary. So, how did that happen? Well, 1400, in its earliest iteration, was passed in 1897 to correct perceived abuses of forum shopping, and the statute did what it's, you know, if you like to read legislative history from 1897, I know that's not a terribly FedSoc thing to do, but they said, look, there's a problem here, and we're trying to solve it, and we're trying to limit the places where plaintiffs can bring patent suits. We don't want them, we don't want defendants to have to go anywhere in the nation to defend against patent litigation. We're gonna enact this narrowing statute as a protection for defendants. And that is what the Supreme Court said about the statute, and it repeatedly said of the statute that when it says you can sue a defendant where the defendant resides, that word in that section of the statute uniquely means state of incorporation. For purposes of 1400B, a corporation resides only in its state of incorporation. The other place you can sue a corporation, other than where it is incorporated, is where it both has a regular and established place of business and commits an act of infringement. So that worked reasonably well, but by the late 70s, early 80s, there was a fear. There was a perception that people were venue shopping to find a good circuit that was more preferable to either plaintiffs or defendants. This is a long while back, but many people seem to think that the Eighth Circuit, for example, never saw a patent that was valid, and other circuits were much more friendly to patent owners. For that and a number of other reasons, Congress created the Court of Appeal for the Federal Circuit and assigned it all appeals from patent cases with the idea that we'll stop having this circuit shopping and we'll have a uniform rule of law for patents around the country by having them all go to a specialized appellate court that hears patent appeals. Very shortly after the formation of the Federal Circuit, they heard a case on venue. And it arose out of a congressional amendment to the venue statutes where they changed the introduction to the lead venue statute, the general venue statute, 28 U.S.C. 1391. And they said the change made it read venue for purposes of this chapter. And then it has the rest of the body of 1391. And the plaintiffs and the Federal Circuit in a case called V.E. Holding, 28 years ago, said, well, what that means is the definition of residence in 1391C applies to any statute that uses that word in the same chapter as 28 U.S.C. 1391. And lo and behold, 1400 is in the same chapter as 1391. So what Congress has done is taken the definition of residence from 1391 and applied it to 1400. So where the Supreme Court said residence in 1400 means state of incorporation, Congress has now corrected that, altered that, and said that residence in 1400 means the same thing it means in 1391, which is anywhere a corporate defendant is subject to personal jurisdiction. Well, that really changes what venue is available, obviously quite broadly. But the change came about, the big alteration in patent litigation and patent venue came about slowly. And it's always important in patent litigation to say there's the law, and the law is very interesting, and then there's the practical reality. And Mike's going to talk more about practical reality than I will. But it's very important to recognize one of the practical realities of venue was that an overwhelming percentage of patent litigation started to be brought in the Eastern District of Texas. And particularly with the rise of the internet and e-commerce and software patents, more and more and more of those kinds of cases were brought by patent holding companies in the Eastern District of Texas. And it was widely perceived that the venue was specially designed to be very favorable to plaintiffs. There were certainly plenty of studies that came to that conclusion. The Federal Trade Commission did a big investigation that came to that conclusion. So from the defense bar didn't like this a heck of a lot. But they were stuck with it because of the fact that a plaintiff could select any venue where a defendant was subject to personal jurisdiction, and obviously the personal jurisdiction tests are fairly broad, and if you're a large corporate entity in the United States doing business across state lines via the internet, you're likely to be subject to personal jurisdiction anywhere you turn. And so most corporate entities could in fact be sued in the Eastern District of Texas, and therefore they were. So for that state of affairs went on for 27-ish years. In the midst of that, Congress once again amended the introductory clause of 1391 and changed it from saying for purposes of this chapter to unless otherwise provided by law. Unless otherwise provided by law, here's a definition of various terms and various venue statutes. And some enterprising folks noticed this, particularly after the Supreme Court pointed it out in a footnote in an unrelated case and said, wait a second, venue in a patent case is otherwise provided by law. It's provided by law in 28 U.S.C. 1400B. Nobody's looked at that in a while, but just as an amendment to the introductory clause of 1391 led to V.E. Holdings, Congress has now changed that back. So that was the theory that led to a number of attempts to overturn V.E. Holding. I took a failed stab at that in the Southern District of California, and then eventually in the District of Delaware, an Indiana LLC called PC Heartland brought that same argument. Lost at the District of Delaware, sought a writ from the Federal Circuit, lost at the Federal Circuit, petitioned for cert, cert was granted. And it's fairly normal in patent litigation that if the Supreme Court grants cert, it's probably to reverse. You're not ever going to get a circuit split because patent cases all go to the Federal Circuit, so the reversal rate of the Federal Circuit at the Supreme Court is fairly high. Sure enough, this argument carried the day, but, and this is important to get to, some of the things that have gone on in the last 5 months, it wasn't the amendment theory that won. Everybody who had challenged this in a district court, including T.C. Heartland, most of the amici that addressed this sort of merits of the statutory interpretation question, focused on the two changes to the introductory clause of 1391. Justice Thomas, writing for a unanimous Supreme Court, said, no, V.E. Holding was always wrong. The definition of residence in 1391C has never applied to 28 U.S.C. 1400B. It's always said exactly what it said. Congress has never amended it. And in a footnote that's very fun for us FedSoc textualist types, he notes, you'll find support for reading the statute this way in this great book by Scalia and Garner called Reading the Law. And he cites to a point in the Scalia-Garner book where Scalia and Garner rely on a Justice Thomas opinion for this very principle that Thomas is once again propounding. So it reverses V.E. Holding. It narrows patent venue. You can now sue a patent defendant, a corporate patent defendant, in its state of incorporation or a district in which it has both committed an act of infringement and has a regular and established place of business. So that's the change. That's the sea change in patent venue as of May 22nd. And what we're now going to address, and I'll turn it over to Mike for this, is sort of what does that mean? What has it meant since May 22nd? What have the cases addressed? How have those decisions come down? And what questions do we think are going to continue to come up, have not been brought up yet, but will be brought up, and where are those? Where do we see those issues headed? So, Mike?
Hi. Thanks, Joel. So, as Joel mentioned, my practice is probably a little bit heavier on the plaintiff side than the defendant side, but just like Joel, I do work on both sides. It's sort of unique in 25, 26 years of practice. The law tends to move slowly, I'm primarily, my practice is district court litigation, a little bit of federal circuit, but mostly I'm at the district court. I'm used to things moving relatively slowly. It doesn't surprise me if I file a motion to compel and I don't get an order from a judge for 4 or 5 months. A summary judgment motion might take 6, 7, 8 months to be ruled on. So I'm used to everything being like the movie Titanic. You see that glacier off in the distance and you know it's coming, but you have no idea when it's actually going to get there. So May 22nd, as Joel said, that was a big deal for us in the trenches, because all of a sudden we get this order from the Supreme Court that we probably should have been expecting, but none of us really were. None of us really thought it was going to go that far. And it makes all of us who have cases in district courts stop, and the first thing we have to do is look over our dockets and see, okay, all of these cases that we have in different districts in the country, which one of them now has proper venue and which doesn't. And it's an exercise not like anything I've ever done in, like I said, like 25 or 26 years, to say I've got cases at all types of various stages. Some have been pending for 9 months, some have been pending for 2 years, some of them I'm just about to file. I have no idea whether or not they've been filed in the right place. And as Joel was saying, a lot of this was very focused on the Eastern District of Texas and non-practicing entities or patent trolls. That wasn't part of my practice. I might have had one or two cases in the Eastern District of Texas that I've filed over the years, but I file cases all over the country. I tend to file them by and large where my client's located, because I want the home court advantage. And you look at that and look at these cases and say, these cases now have to go someplace else, maybe. So in several of my cases, defendants filed motions to dismiss or motions to transfer for improper venue, and we all went straight to that waiver argument. And that's one of the first questions that came up. Venue is something that can be waived. And so in all of my cases, like in other people's cases, we start looking at the record really quickly and saying, okay, in our complaints, we usually allege venue, and that's That's a good Voivode to a venue is proper in this district. And prior to TC Heartland, almost every defendant would admit that paragraph. So they would admit the venue is proper. So our position at that point as a plaintiff would be venue is waivable. We all know that's true under under Rule 12. And so if they admitted that venue is proper in a particular district, that must mean that the issue is closed. And the first couple of decisions that came out on this issue, after someone had either admitted to venue or it they'd continued to litigate, so arguably they consented to venue, was that venue probably hadn't been waived because it wasn't really a knowing waiver. And the way the courts would analyze this is to say, well, had there been an intervening change in law? Was TC Heartland a change in law or not? And the very first few cases that came out, the judges seemed to be holding that, well, of course TC Heartland was a change in law. We were all just talking about that. It was an enormous change of law from what had been the regime for the previous 27 years. But then other courts looked at it a different way and say, you know, the Supreme Court didn't say that it was a change in law. The Supreme Court seemed to say this had always been the law, and the Federal Circuit had just been ignoring it, or they'd gone their own way in B holding. But this is the law. It's always been the law. And so we ended up with a wave of cases that all held that because there had been no change of law, then the issue of venue had, in fact, been waived. And so there were lots of defendants who were told, you're stuck where you were because you didn't challenge venue in the first place. The tide, you know, it's funny to be able to talk in terms of history when we're only talking about 4 or 5 months, but the tide initially was against waiver and saying that the objection of venue had been preserved because there had been a change of law. Then there were a lot of cases that said that that there had been waiver. And now I think the tide looks like it's going a little bit back the other way. And more of the cases in the last month or so have been holding that that the objection to venue hasn't been waived. But that's one of the things that still needs to be sorted out. And that's for the existing cases. The cases that are being filed now, every time we file a new case, of course, we have to analyze TC Heartland, and we have to analyze the precedents that are out there. And what we've been weighing is, do we look to the very strict interpretation of TC Heartland, regular established place of business where there's been infringement? And by strict interpretation, what I mean is there actually an actual physical place where the defendant is doing business, or can it be something a little bit less than that? And the initial reaction that all of us had was, you know, that this statute 1400B looks pretty clear to us. The Supreme Court in TC Heartland looked like they had come up with a pretty clear decision. So we need to look in terms of a strict physical place of business. And then it looked like there were some cracks. We had a decision from a district court, I believe it was in Washington, that said, well, we're open to allowing a little bit of discovery into venue issues. And the discovery that they were going to allow was pretty broad. It looked like it was much more than just discovery that'd be necessary to determine whether or not there was an actual physical place of business. And then Judge Gilstrap, down in the Eastern District of Texas, threw the plaintiffs of the world a huge bone. He came out with his decision in Raytheon versus Cray. And Raytheon versus Cray, he said something that seemed to make some practical sense. He said that if we're going to look at what a regular established place of business is in the modern era, then I think what we need to do is look beyond necessarily whether or not there's a brick and mortar physical place of business, and instead look to, you know, maybe four factors that could be relevant. Certainly we'll consider whether there's a physical presence, but we also want to take a look at what representations the defendant made about where they do business. We should look at the benefits that the defendant received from doing business in that district and targeted interactions with that district. And once you start looking at a four-factor test like that, which is pretty amorphous, it starts to sound a lot like personal jurisdiction. And when you look at that type of a test, you think, okay, maybe this is going to be one of those things that the Supreme Court issues an order, issues an opinion, and the Federal Circuit doesn't completely ignore it, but isn't going to 100% let the Supreme Court get its way. And this seemed to be what Gilstrap was trying to get at, is to give the Federal Circuit a way to walk away from a strict interpretation of T.C. Heartland. If that decision had held, if that type of four-factor test were adopted, almost any case as a practical matter could be legitimately filed in Texas. And the standard is so amorphous, almost any case in theory could stay there. And because judges take a long time to rule on all types of motions, including motions dismissed for lack of venue, and because judges were allowing discovery to take place, you could go right back to where we were before, where someone could file a lawsuit in Marshall, Texas, and the defense could be sure that they were going to be there for a long time, 9 to 12 months, possibly long enough that they'll have to do infringement contentions and validity contentions, start discovery, and you're right back to where you were before, where the nuisance value of a lawsuit in Marshall, Texas was actually pretty high and it was pretty compelling to settle the case, even if the merits weren't very strong. So that was in June. When Gilstrap issued that order, it didn't take the Federal Circuit 3 full months on mandamus to say no. And at that point, the Federal Circuit on the mandamus petition ruled that Gilstrap was wrong. There's no four-factor test. Maybe modern times have changed the way people do business, but it doesn't change the statute. They have an opinion that, Joel pointed out a few minutes ago that the Supreme Court's decision, T.C. Heartland, was a model of perfect Federalist Society textual interpretation of the law. The Federal Circuit decision in Ray Cray was just the same, literal interpretation of the text, and they insisted on a physical presence. In light of that, for plaintiffs, it really closed a lot of doors in terms of creativity based on the law right now. And what we're seeing is cases being filed all around the country, pretty much where they should be based on where the defendant is. And you're seeing plaintiffs who do file in the wrong district being very willing, when venue is challenged, to simply stipulate to transfer. And then the last thing that we've seen from the district courts as well is, and this just seems to be a collateral effect of T.C. Heartland, is district court judges seem much more willing to grant 1404 transfer motions than they were before. There's nothing in the decision in T.C. Heartland that compels that, but I think it sort of put judges in the mode of, venue might be a close call, but let's go ahead and transfer it for form nonconvenience. You're seeing cases being filed in different places than they were before and being moved to different places. And then the other impact is, we talk so much about Texas and we talk so much about the other districts. The other impact that we've seen is from the first part of 1400B, which is you can sue a defendant where they're incorporated. And that puts a lot of focus back in Delaware, since so many companies are incorporated in Delaware.
Yeah, so some of the effect we've seen in Delaware is very interesting. The court is relatively small, obviously because it's a state of incorporation for so many businesses. It's got a pretty busy docket. It's got a couple of judges who saw a lot of patent cases, have recently taken senior status, and are not on the wheel. They're not taking more cases. They are extraordinarily overloaded with patent cases right now, and their transfer opinions pretty bluntly reflect that. So they have been more active in 1404 transfers because, of course, if you sue a Delaware corporation in district court in Delaware, venue's proper, there's no personal jurisdiction question, you absolutely can be there. And the defendants have been able to get those cases transferred out of Delaware despite, they're not a lot, but there's a couple of them where they, sure, we incorporated here, but judge, do you really want another patent case? And that's that motion has fallen on welcoming ears in the District of Delaware to an unusual extent in the last few months. And the judges have frankly acknowledged that part of that is the caseload they're under and the fact that they're calling on fellow federal judges from Pennsylvania to come pick up some of that caseload right now. So I'm going to move on to the questions that a plaintiff and a defendant in a patent case face post TC Heartland, and Mike will sort of go back and forth on some of these particular issues. One that is a split among district courts at the moment is simply who bears the burden of proof and at what level on a venue transfer motion under 1400B. So the plaintiff comes in, it used to be you would come in and say venue's proper under 1391C and 1400B, and what you really meant was this entity is subject to personal jurisdiction, and everybody would agree and move on. Well, now you come in and allege as a plaintiff that venue is proper under 1400B, and in fact, what we're seeing is plaintiffs, good plaintiffs, smart plaintiffs' lawyers, are alleging facts to support that. They allege facts to show that a defendant has a regular and established place of business in the district. So they will allege facts about, a warehouse, an office, personnel, you know, who's there and under what circumstances is a person from the corporation living, working in what kind of space in the district. And they will have to allege that the entity committed an act of infringement in the district. If the defendant says, no, actually I'm denying that, none of that's true, who bears the burden of showing, and so far the question has all been, is there a regular and established place of business in the district? Who bears the burden of proof on that? And there is a split among district courts. Some have said, look, it's always the case the defendant bears the burden of showing that venue is improper. Others have looked at this in a way that I think my sense is probably more likely correct under the cases. The plaintiff has the burden of showing that venue is proper. The defendant has the burden of showing that venue, proper venue, ought not be respected under 1404, form nonconvenience transfer. But I don't think that the cases support the idea that the defendant has a burden of showing venue was never proper in the first place. Right now, the Eastern District of Texas has taken the position that on a transfer motion or a motion to dismiss, it's the defendant's burden to show that venue is not proper. I think most other districts have gone the other way and said, if the defendant denies venue at all, denies the allegations as to venue, contests venue, moves to dismiss for improper venue, it's the plaintiff's burden to demonstrate the facts that show that venue is proper. Another interesting twist in it is that venue is proper in a district where the defendant has committed an act of infringement. And here the courts have been very uniform in saying we need a sufficient factual allegation. I'm not sure anybody's quite cited Iqbal and Twombly, but that seems to be the gist of it. If you've alleged sufficient facts to make that plausible, that's enough at the venue stage. We're not going to go to the extent of litigating the merits of whether or not there was infringement in order to decide whether or not there's venue. Venue is a preliminary question. We're going to address that in a fairly preliminary manner. One very interesting case on this came up in the context of it was either drugs or a medical device because there's a safe harbor. And so the defendant said, well, I admit that I sold that allegedly infringing device, but I have an affirmative defense under the statute that I was allowed to do that for medical research purposes, that it is not actually infringing because of this medical research safe harbor. And the district court said, look, that's an affirmative defense. You admitted you sold the thing. That's enough for venue. If you win on your affirmative defense, it turns out not to have been infringing, but we're not going to get into the merits of an affirmative defense to decide whether or not venue is proper in the first instance. Mike, any thoughts on sort of what good, what's a good pleading for a plaintiff, and what should a defendant be trying to do to actually just get over that first hurdle of, I've picked a court, I think it's the right court, how do we get here, how do we stay here?
So my reaction to that when I'm representing a plaintiff, I mean, I typically, you know, I try and do as much homework and diligence as I can, but, you know, I'm dealing with facts that aren't really in my control to the extent they're on the defense. I'm not going to know nearly as well whether or not they have a regular established place of business. I mean, if it's Apple, I can check and see that, yes, there's an Apple store in the district, and I feel pretty good about it. But a lot of circumstances, you just don't know. What I would like to do in a situation like this, just to be prepared, is to plead as much as I can. Like you said, there's some uncertainty as to who's going to bear the burden. I think in general, a district court's reaction is on any type of a Rule 12 motion to want to take the facts alleged in the complaint as true. So if I have facts that I can allege, I think it sets me up in a better position to have a judge say, I'm going to accept those facts as true, and I'm going to put the burden on the defendant. I don't think it's unreasonable to say that the burden should be on the defense to prove the venue is improper, because most of the things that it's going to turn on are those facts that are uniquely within the defendant's control. Inevitably, we're going to see arguments about when you look at Crane, you look at what types of analyses are going to be going into it, especially, you know, in the modern world where you have flexible work environments and corporations have multiple subsidiaries and sister corporations and they operate under affiliated trade names. There can be confusion as to whether or not, just because there is an office in a office park that has the name of a company, just the generic name of the company, it could be an affiliate company, it could be a subsidiary. Those people that look like they're employees, they might not actually be employees, they might all be contractors, and there could be all kinds of issues that are raised there. And those are facts that are within the defendant's control, not the plaintiff.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel pretty good about being able to argue that, well, of course the burden should be on the defendant to come forward with proof of that. But as the plaintiff, I'm going to put the best facts that I know, and I'm going to put as many of them as I can in the complaint. So that way I have for a second reason too, I've seen a few cases where judges have at least entertained the notion that when a case is brought in the wrong venue, and you lose a motion to dismiss for venue, if the facts are way off, if it's not even a close call, that they've seen judges have been willing to at least entertain award of attorney's fees,
mm-hmm,
against the plaintiff for having filed in the wrong district. So I would like to be able to show the guy had the defendant's a Delaware corporation, and I had a good reason to sue them in San Diego. I'd like to be able to put that up right up front.
Another question for you. As the district courts have grappled with this question of who bears that burden, so the general rule, of course, is that questions unique to patent law are resolved by the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit applies Federal Circuit law to patent questions, which they say they're going to do for 1400B, right? What does it mean to have a regular and established place of business? That's going to be a question of Federal Circuit law. Procedural issues are evaluated under the rule of the regional circuit in which the district court sits. Which one is this going to be? Is this going to be a question for that if the Fourth Circuit says it's the plaintiff's burden to demonstrate that venue is proper in the first instance, and the Fifth Circuit says, hey, it's the defendant's burden to show that venue is wrong, is there going to be regional variance in who bears the burden at that motion to dismiss stage? Or do you think the Federal Circuit's going to step in and say, for purposes of 1400B, that ceases to be procedural and it's actually substantive rights?
Yeah, I mean, I suspect, and I'm going to take a very practical view of this one, that the Federal Circuit is probably going to either say very clearly, this is Federal Circuit law, and our law applies, not regional circuit law applies, or they're going to say, they're going to come up with some reason to reconcile it and say, you know, we apply the procedural law of the Fifth Circuit, but in this instance, because of the way it's going to be, the way it evaluated, it's going to be handled slightly differently. But they'll find a way to have uniform law. I just don't see there being the Federal Circuit being interested in weighing it differently. Otherwise, you're going to end up with form shopping again.
Yes. No, I agree. Practically, that seems likely to me, and it struck me as interesting that the district courts have said, look, this is procedural. The Federal Circuit says we apply procedural rules of our regional circuit, so I'm looking to Fourth Circuit law on who bears this burden. But I tend to agree with you. We're going to get a Federal Circuit case that somehow finesses that and makes a uniform rule. Just add a couple of things to your comments on the regular and established place of business. I agree there's a lot of that information that's uniquely in the control of the defendant, but I would say it depends on how hard a plaintiff's working to avoid state of incorporation or the state of the defendant's principal place of business. That is, for a corporate defendant, there are at least some places where it's really easy to identify. They definitely have a physical presence here. This is where their business is headquartered. If you're trying to go somewhere else because you think it's more favorable, it might be harder to know that you really belong there. But I, you know, as someone who's more on the defense side, I would say, well, you know, you're electing that extra burden to say, I'm going to sue somebody other than in their principal place of business where I know for certain they've got an establishment. Not the defendant's choice that you're going to take that stretch. So I'm not sure it necessarily follows that it should be their burden to show that you're wrong. I think, Mike, if you've got anything else on that, otherwise maybe we should talk about the question that no district court has really looked at yet that I think is going to be really interesting. Where does a defendant commit an act of infringement? So, again, your two choices for suing the defendant, place where they're incorporated, on the one hand, or where that defendant meets two conditions, has a regular and established place of business, which is definitely a physical presence out of which they do, you know, they actually conduct their business, but also where they've committed an act of infringement. And what makes this one so interesting to me is, again, nobody's looked at this in almost 30 years. The Federal Circuit had maybe one or two cases evaluating 1400B before they decided VE Holding and quit looking at it. And everybody on the phone realizes the world has changed a lot in 30 years. This is like Rip Van Winkle waking up, you know, from his deep sleep and looking around and saying, what's this internet thing? So not only has the world of commerce changed, we now have e-commerce sites, people solicit business over the internet, they conclude contracts over the internet, you can digitally sign contracts. That didn't happen before VE Holding was decided. The patent statute itself has changed. The things that constitute acts of infringement have changed in the last 30 years while no one looked at this portion of the statute. And the one that stands out most notably to me is it now is an act of infringement not merely to sell an infringing device, but also to offer to sell an infringing device. So a lot of the cases just before the formation of the Federal Circuit and VE Holding had to do with where did a salesman sell an infringing device. If the salesman is wandering around the district, got a car, he's got a pad, he's got a pencil, he writes down the order, he mails the order back to headquarters in a different state, and headquarters decides whether or not to accept that order. Most of the cases said the sale happens where headquarters decides to accept the order, not where the salesman solicits it. But of course, that's a physical presence in a district making an offer to sell. There's no doubt that all of those cases, the pad, the pencil, the fax machine, were offers to sell, but an offer was not in the statute. So what happens now? What happens where does a defendant sell or offer if the defendant maintains, let's imagine, the defendant in the fictional state of Colombia is incorporated in Colombia, has its headquarters in Colombia, and has an internet presence. And anyone in the United States can log on to their computer at home, navigate to Acme Widget Corp's website, and purchase widgets from this corporation. Where does the corporation make the offer, and where does it make the sale? So this has not yet come up in any cases in the last 5 months, but I think it's going to. I think especially a close reading of the Federal Circuit's decision in In re Cray, they say very, very clearly the venue rules are not the personal jurisdiction rules. So the example I've given people from Washington is, if you imagine that you're standing on the north bank of the Columbia River, negligently gesticulating with a rifle, and you discharge it and hit someone on the south bank of the river, for personal jurisdiction purposes, you know that you could be hailed into the courts of Oregon on the south bank of the river, because it's reasonably foreseeable that your negligence in Washington would injure someone in Oregon. But the Federal Circuit said that's not the question we're asking. That's not what the statute says. That's not what the text of the statute says. And personal jurisdiction isn't the question. The question, I think, will be, where was the defendant physically located when the defendant did the thing that constitutes an act of infringement? And so I think that's going to narrow venue for defendants who primarily act over the internet. That you may have some kind of physical presence in a state, but not sell or offer in the state. Even if the offer is received or the sale is received in the state, you make the offer elsewhere. Again, that's not one that's come up at all. And I think, you know, me from the defense side and Mike from the plaintiff side probably have different views on how that might come out. So, Mike, I'll drop that on your lap.
Yeah, so, I mean, my guess is it's going to come out. It's going to, just because the way the pendulum has been swinging, I feel pretty confident that it's ultimately going to come out the way defendants would like it to come out, and that an offer is going to be held to be made where the defendant happened to be at the moment he expressed the offer, and they're not going to look to see, well, where was the offer received. They're not going to look to see where was the author aiming, where was the defendant aiming his offer, but where he happened physically to be, because that does seem to be the emphasis of it. That issue isn't raised only in the context of offers. I think that issue also comes up, and I haven't given it as much thought as you have, Joel, but where there's a question of divided infringement. I'd be interested to hear if you've had any thoughts on that. On that issue.
Yeah, so that one's going to be, I think, even trickier, where, you know, much of the case law on divided infringement, this is where, particularly in method-type claims, one entity performs part of the method, another entity performs another part, or one entity builds part of the device, another entity builds the rest of it. You need to sue them both, because you've got to have all steps of the method or all parts of the device for there to be infringement. And what you've typically had to show is some level of coordination between them, that they knew what they were doing, they did it intentionally, they sort of meant to split up these steps. That test has gotten more stringent, but it is nowhere near the level, correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, I would say it's nowhere near the level of veil piercing, right? You don't have to show sort of those levels of fraud to dissolve a corporate form to reach joint defendants. Yet that standard seems to be hinted at in some of the much older cases under the venue statute, of saying, you know, I've got two entities, one of which has the place of business and the other of which is actually doing the sales, but they're acting in concert. The older decisions come much closer to saying that kind of joint allegation requires veil piercing. So I will be very interested to see what level of coordination do you have to allege between your joint defendants to be able to say that venue's proper. The risk, of course, being, and I don't think the courts will let this happen, you know, Company A has proper venue in, you know, one state. Company B venue's only proper in a different state, but you have to sue them both to have a full active infringement, and now there's no place you can sue them. I'm confident, I think, that the courts will allow some kind of pleading around that problem, that they won't allow defendants to carefully divide infringement in such a way as to render their no district court where they can be called on for their actions.
Yeah, because I think that what is required is for divided infringement is much less than veil piercing, somewhat less than agency as well, which is not enough to impute to impute context for venue.
Right.
Should we open the floor to questions?
Absolutely.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing a caller from the audience, would you both like to continue your discussion, or I can ask a different question?
Why don't you ask a different question?
Sure. So I wanted to ask what TC Heartland's impact is on foreign corporations.
So the Supreme Court was very clear on that in its decision in TC Heartland to say this decision does not apply to foreign corporations, and we take no position whatsoever as to whether or not as to how this might apply to foreign corporations. I know that there have been. So the way that it comes up is if you have a foreign corporation that does not have a regular established place of business in the U.S., so it's not incorporated in any particular state, so it's not a resident of any state under 1400B, and it doesn't have a regular established place of business. So under the strict terms of the statute, there would be no place to sue a foreign corporation for infringing a United States patent, even if there are acts of infringement here in the U.S. A number of foreign corporations have raised that. It looks like the district courts that have started to look at that have said no, that TC Heartland does not apply to foreign corporations. The general venue statute will probably apply, and you'll be able to sue a foreign corporation wherever you can find personal jurisdiction. And I know that I've seen at least one tentative ruling from a district court saying that. And I think, Joel, you had mentioned that you've seen at least one district court ruling, actual ruling, that has said that as well.
I think it was an actual one, but we might have been reading the same tentative ruling. But I think you're right. Again, it's one where the courts are not going to allow ready evasion of being answerable for, you know, this federal statutory tort. And so thus far what we've seen is they said – you may be right that there's no proper venue under 1400B, but it doesn't matter because for foreign corporations, 1391 governs venue.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Friday, October 20th at 12 noon. That will be a courthouse steps call on Jesner v. Arab Bank, which was argued in the court last week. The call featured Professor William R. Casto of Texas Tech University School of Law and Professor Samuel S. Stryker of New York University School of Law. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded telephone calls you may have missed. Not seeing any questions from the audience, I can ask another of my own. Does the Bristol-Myers Squibb personal jurisdiction decision apply to and affect recovery in patent cases?
So I think it will. This is an issue that TC Heartland raised in the district court in Delaware. They raised it again to the Federal Circuit. It was not an issue on cert to the Supreme Court. The general idea here is that a corporation is subject to general personal jurisdiction in only one or two locations, one or two states, certainly the state of incorporation and the state of its principal place of business, but probably just those two places. And there's a long series of cases that where the Supreme Court has essentially been tightening up personal jurisdiction and saying, if you want to recover for all sorts of different things that a corporation did in different states, you need to sue them in one of the places where they're subject to general jurisdiction. And Bristol-Myers Squibb, one of the reasons that one, to me, really tees up the patent issue is that the premise in that case was, even assuming that Bristol-Myers Squibb committed exactly the same tort with exactly the same advertising regarding exactly the same drug that had exactly the same effect on all these plaintiffs, if you want to recover, you can't sue us in California and recover for an Indiana plaintiff or a Nebraska plaintiff. An Indiana plaintiff can sue us in Indiana. A California plaintiff can sue us in California, but we're not subject to general jurisdiction in any of those states. If all of you together want to recover from us, you need to come to our state of incorporation or the state of our principal place of business. The Federal Circuit, quite a long time ago, said that that is not true in patent cases, but it appears that that case and everything that it relied on in coming up with that rule has been slowly eaten away by the Supreme Court, and probably Beverly Hills Fan is not good law. And if you want to get a full recovery from a patent defendant for every act of infringement, each act of infringement being a separate and distinct tort, if you want the full recovery, you can sue them in their state of incorporation or the state of their principal place of business. But if you find proper venue in another state, your recovery may well be limited to only the torts that the defendant committed in that state. And so I think coupled with TC Heartland, I think patent defendants are taking a closer look at Bristol-Myers Squibb and sort of companion cases, BNSF Railroad, a couple tire company cases that came out the same way, and are going to start to try to limit damages recovery by patent plaintiffs, even if venue is proper, in a state other than a state of incorporation or principal place of business. And I, to my mind, the net effect of that will probably be to spread patent cases pretty far and wide around the country, which, of course, was some of the original intent of the patent venue statute, 1400B, was to say these cases should be brought where the defendants are, and since defendants are all over the country, patent cases will be all over the country as a result. Mike, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that one.
No, I think that's right, and I think that that's a, as a policy matter, I think that's a good thing. I think all of this is a good thing from TC Heartland and Cray and all of it. Because what you had, the situation that you had when you were allowed foreign shopping, of course, is plaintiffs' attorneys get to decide where to file their cases, get to decide where most of the cases are filed. And we ended up with a situation where, as everyone observed, East District of Texas was handling, I can't remember what the percentage was, but the majority of cases. And, of course, plaintiffs' attorneys are good at filing cases where the law, where the procedures are most favorable, where the environment for nuisance value settlements is the most favorable, where the rules for jury trials are the most favorable. And that causes the law to tilt in an unhealthy way. It tilts the balance away from what we normally see in other areas of the law. Combined with the fact that a single court of appeal, you ended up with, uniformity is good, but uniformity being tilted in a particular way. And to be able to spread the cases throughout the district, so you have judges whose business and lifeblood isn't patent law, but as business, they have to balance that patent law against all types of other cases with very, very busy caseloads, that's healthy. It allows judges to hear the cases that have different perspectives. It allows you to have jurors who aren't part of a jury pool where they're constantly handling patent cases. And I think it's going to allow the law to develop in a healthier way and at a healthier pace. Patent law has developed very, very quickly and possibly in a lot of areas a little bit too quickly. And hopefully this will help get better ideas into the system and maybe moderate the pace as well.
Well, it's certainly been a breakneck pace of development on the meaning and application of 1400B for the last 5 months, and I think that that pace is not likely to slow down for the next 5 months. So it's been really fun and interesting to litigate in an area of the law that, again, hadn't been touched for 30 years, and all of a sudden we all get to take a fresh look at it, and we have seen very rapid pace of change there.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any, would either of you like to make some closing remarks?
No, thanks very much.
I think I made mine a moment ago, so thank you.
Great. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.